Hello, welcome to Outdoors in Scotland. I'm John Burns, and this is my podcast for people who like the outdoors in Scotland. Really, it does what it says on the tin, you know. When I started climbing ice in Scotland many years ago, you know, as a young climber, you look through guidebooks, and one name that occurred over and over again in creating and first ascents was that of Harold Raeburn. And it's only recently I realized I knew very little about him as a man. And I think that's been a big gap in my knowledge, certainly. Someone who Robin Campbell described as the father of Scottish mountaineering. So I'm going to talk today to Peter Bigger, who's written, I think, what is sure to be the definitive biography of Harold Raeburn, The Steps of a Giant. About how that book came about. And before I do that, I'm going to make a little confession. I've known Peter for many, many years, and without his encouragement, I would probably never have written a word. So it's basically all his fault. If I can introduce... How are you, Peter?
I'm fine, John. Thank you. It's nice weather in Torridon today.
Well, that's a rare thing at the moment, isn't it?
It certainly is.
We've not had a great winter, it has to be said. Can I ask you, what sparked your interest to write about Harold Raeburn?
Well, I think various things. As you say, John, as one grows up as a climber, one finds Harold's name all over the guidebooks. I think that was the first thing, and I wanted to know who this character was. And I was very fortunate to have a friend called Mike Jacob, who became seriously interested in Harold Raeburn.
Right.
And did a vast amount of research into his life. Then also, I started to read the writings of Robin Campbell, who became probably the leading expert, the late Robin Campbell, I should say, on Raeburn, and all these things stimulated my interest.
And this is a difficult question to ask a man who's written many thousand words about somebody. But for the listeners who don't know Harold Raeburn, could you tell us, give you a little potted sort of biography in a way about when was he climbing and what was his sort of influence?
Yes, well, Harold Raeburn climbed really at the end of the 19th century and the start of the 20th. He was from quite a well-off family. He had 11 siblings, and they lived in Edinburgh, and his father and grandfather had both been brewers, and Harold, when he left school, joined the family business, and he became a brewer, so he was quite well off.
All right.
And eventually he joined the Scottish Mountaineering Club. You know, he began, in fact, by collecting birds' eggs, which was something which people did in those days, which is very much not frowned on nowadays. And he climbed up to Eagle's Eyries and all that sort of thing. And quite without knowing it, he became interested in rock climbing. And, you know, he eventually found that there was an excellent crag above Edinburgh, Salisbury Crags, and he went up there on his own and started practicing.
Right.
And he became very good at it. And he also met one or two other people. One of them was Willie Douglas, who happened to be the editor of the Scottish Mountaineering Club Journal. And Douglas introduced him to the SMC, and that really was the start of his serious, serious climbing life. From then on, he climbed new routes all over Scotland, Loch Na Garr, Ben Nevis, Skye, etc., etc., and the Cairngorms. And he, of course, went abroad initially to the Alps for a couple of years, but he got sick of what he called padding behind guides. And he went to Norway and found Norway much more interesting for a couple of years because they didn't climb with guides. And he did various newer ascents in Norway. And then he got back to alpine climbing and really went in for it in a big way and did things like the traverse of the Matterhorn, the ascent of Mont Blanc by a different and hard route. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he climbed the Dent Blanche. He traversed that by the southeast and northeast ridge. And he did numerous ascents in the Alps. Possibly one of the most famous was the ascent of the north face of Monte Disgrazia.
Mm-hmm.
Not content with the Alps, he moved on to the Caucasus and led two expeditions in 1913 and 1914 to the Caucasus. The second, of course, was interrupted by the First World War. After the war, he got back to climbing very quickly and made the first solo traverse of the Meije, very, very fine alpine peak,
mm-hmm.
which had not actually been had a solo traverse done before. He ascended for the very first time in winter Observatory Ridge on Ben Nevis, taking only 5 3/4 hours, which most people with modern equipment take double the time.
Right.
He went to Kanchenjunga, and eventually, after all this, he became the mountaineering leader of the very first expedition to Mount Everest under Howard Bury. Most people call it Berry, but he was actually Irish, so it's Howard Bury.
Well, what date was that, Peter?
1921.
Right, because there was a 1922 expedition as well, and a 24, wasn't there, obviously?
That's right. Mm-hmm. Oh. But, of course, at the end, halfway through the 1921 expedition, Raeburn's close friend, the Aberdonian Alexander Kallas, died of dysentery. Oh. And Raeburn probably caught the same disease and was exceedingly ill and had to be invalided out of the expedition, and he went to a place called Gangtok and recovered, basically. And after about 10 weeks, he walked right over Tibet and got back to the expedition. But by this time, of course, George Mallory had taken over as mountaineering leader. And, you know, the scope for Raeburn's skill was much, much reduced. It wasn't that he did nothing on the expedition. He climbed a peak of over 20,000 feet. He got to very near the North Col, but he felt very, very disappointed that illness had sort of meant that he couldn't do all that he wanted to on Mount Everest.
Right.
And when he came back, he suffered a recurrence of his old problem, which was that very modern disease, melancholia, as it was called then, or depression. He'd suffered from this in 1911. That's actually recorded. And he felt he'd been very badly treated by the expedition. I think you will know this as a mountaineer, John. When you go on an expedition, there's always somebody who becomes the sort of butt of sneers and jokes and so on. And I think Raeburn fell into that category. And he wasn't really given his proper dues.
Right.
by the mountaineering establishment and by the Mount Everest Committee. And he became seriously depressed when he got back to Edinburgh. And he spent the last 4 years of his life in Craig House, which is a mental asylum. And he eventually died in 1926. Now, that's a very short potted history of his life.
We can't get 150,000 words in at the moment, so we'll have to do it briefly. But yeah, I mean, I hadn't realised just how prolific a mountaineer was. A mountaineer he was, and in many ways, one of the ascents that you talk about in the book is his climb of Green Gully, which is an ice climb on the north face of Ben Nevis, and that stood as a a monumental climb for quite some time, didn't it?
That's right. Now, that was done in 1906 with a Swiss gentleman whom he'd never met before. He was recommended to climb with him by the Reverend A.E. Robertson, the first Monroeist.
Oh, right.
Yeah, because Robertson was apparently suffering from a cold or something, and also this climb was done on a Sunday, and Robertson, being a minister, perhaps disapproved.
I didn't realise that.
One doesn't really know.
But this is the days when he would have been climbing, obviously, at that time. He would have been step-cutting, hacking his way up, essentially.
He was step-cutting the whole blessed way.
With virtually no protection, I would have thought. I mean, today we have ice screws and various chocks and things that we can put in all over the place. But in his day, they would, particularly on Green Gully, I would have thought, they would largely have been climbing unprotected.
There were, John. I mean, you know Green Gully. You've done it. I've done it. It's a steep ice climb, basically. And, you know, even nowadays, protection can be hard to find. In fact, they had nothing to protect themselves with except their two long ice axes, and they had clinker-nailed boots, and that was that.
Yeah. I mean, can be a challenging climb even with modern equipment, as I found out. I've actually done it twice. The second time it was completely out of condition and I shouldn't have tried it, which is the start of one of my books, to be honest. But was it repeated as a climb for 30 years, or did it stand as, you know, the hardest, one of the hardest ice climbs probably in the world at that time? Is that fair?
Very much so, yes. I think it was probably the hardest ice climb in the world at that time. And it wasn't repeated until 1938. And for many, many years, people thought that J.H.B. Bell and his companions had made the first ascent. And there's a famous picture of J.H.B. Bell cutting steps up Green Gully. And it was only in the early 1970s that Robin Campbell actually found this account in the SMC Journal for 1907, I think it is. It could be 1906, I can't quite remember. And, you know, Raeburn actually wanted to climb the cone.
Right, yeah, which is the ridge right next door to it, isn't it?
Which is the ridge just to the left of Green Gully.
Yeah.
But, of course, they couldn't do it, and he couldn't get back onto the cone from Green Gully.
Yeah.
So he just went on up Green Gully. And actually, at the end of his article, he sounds almost apologetic. You know, he says, well, it wasn't quite the climb of the cone, but we had a very good day, and that was what we went up for.
taciturn's not the right word, but he wasn't a man who promoted his own achievements, from what I understand. Is that correct?
I think that's absolutely right, John. I mean, George Mallory, by contrast, was excellent at blowing his own trumpet. Raeburn just couldn't do this at all. He was a very modest man, very quiet. You know, his articles, apart from one or two, don't emphasize his position as leader at all.
Right.
You'd hardly know that he led the climb.
Right.
He was that sort of mountaineer, an extremely modest man.
Right. It's interesting, I mean, obviously, you yourself were an editor of the SMC Journal for a while, and it's interesting that how significant that journal has been. Was it a huge source of information to you going back over the years?
Yes, the SMC Journal was incredibly useful to me. It contained a lot of Raeburn's articles. It also contained his excursions pieces. Now, these were little articles in which people who didn't want to write a full article could just include the details of their climbs.
Right.
And Raeburn often contributed to that. But he did write some very, very outstanding articles as well. The obvious one is From Sea to Sunlit Summit. And in that article, Raeburn describes the first ascent, which was a solo ascent of Observatory Buttress on Ben Nevis. Now, he'd been at sea. He was also a sailor. He'd been at sea competing in a sailing race in off Leith in Edinburgh.
Right.
He got becalmed, and they came up. He came up to Port William after about a couple of hours' sleep, and he marches up the Alta Vullin, shedding his clothes right and left, and eventually arrives below Observatory Buttress, where he had arranged to meet William Ingalls Clark, who was a friend, and his wife, Jane. But they were doing something else, and Raeburn saw them in the distance on Tower Ridge and thought, well, they're never going to get here. So eventually, you know, having talked a great deal about the bird life and the insect life and the plant life and everything else, all he says about the climb is, oh, well, I went up, and that's the only. It's the only Observatory Buttress and a solo ascent it was, and he takes great delight in getting to the summit and going to the summit hotel, and having tea with jam with his friends.
that's the style you want to do it, isn't it? Really,
absolutely love jam. I have actually wondered, John, sometimes, you know, this article is so over the top for Raeburn. He discusses almost everything in it. He talks about golf and sailing and all sorts of things in this article. I have sometimes wondered if it was so much over the top that this was partly, the other side of the Deep Depression.
Yes, sort of bipolar thing.
Did he actually suffer from bipolar disorder?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
One thing that makes me partly suspicious is that psychiatrists say that if somebody suffers trauma in their teens, this can spark this terrible mental disorder.
Right.
And Raeburn, of course, lost one of his brothers by drowning when he was 15.
Oh, right, you didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, well, it's all in the book. And, this just may have sparked some mental disorder. We don't know. We don't know. There isn't sufficient evidence to say.
This is a rather peculiar question, but he would have been a contemporary of my old friend Alistair Crowley. Did the two ever come in contact?
The answer is simple. I don't know.
Okay.
I just don't know.
It's likely, in a way, because obviously the climbing community is a relatively small community. In those days, I suppose it was even much, much smaller than it is today. And Crowley was at his peak climbing in about 1905, 1906, that kind of time. So I'm sure he would have known of Crowley, because Crowley...
It would have been... Yeah, it would have been remarkable if they'd never heard of each other. Very remarkable.
Yes, that's right. And one of the things I read in your book, which surprised me, I suppose it shouldn't have surprised me really, but is that when they were, when we talk about grades of climbs, which obviously rates their difficulty, in the early years, there was really no distinction between rock climbing grades and winter climbs. So when did they begin to develop the sort of the system of grading winter climbs as distinct from rock?
It didn't really start, until the very late 40s and early 50s.
Quite a long time after he...
Long time. Raeburn always seems to want to climb the rocks, and he climbs the rocks in whatever condition they are, whether they're covered with snow or ice or whatever, or whether they're wet, and I think he himself certainly, you know, by the time he's climbing Green Gully, he is starting to make a big distinction between winter and summer climbing. Right. And of course, in 1920, when he climbs Observatory Ridge in winter, right, then he has certainly made the distinction between winter and summer climbing. But it takes a long, long time for the Scottish mountain authorities to get round to doing anything about a separate grading system. It really is quite remarkable.
It is, when you consider just how how different those two conditions were. I mean, climbing one thing in the summer and climbing it again in winter, it's almost a totally different experience, really.
Totally different, John. Yes, you're absolutely right. But you have to remember that the Victorian climbers' experience of snow didn't really start in Scotland, the Lake District, or Wales, but it started in the Alps.
Right.
So they were used to climbing this beautiful, hard snow and getting onto lovely, dry rock.
Ah, right, okay.
And that was what they were used to, you see.
Right, because at that time, a lot of the mountaineers, it's a strange phrase, you could almost call them gentleman mountaineers. I mean, it was only later that working class folk began to climb. I think that's right, isn't it?
That's right, John, yes, very much so.
And so they employed guides in the Alps. And I think that's a very important point, really, about the development of Scottish winter climbing, in that the sort of the hard neve and warm, dry rock, in a way that you're describing, existed in the Alps, but it very rarely existed in Scotland, in my experience.
Exactly right.
Sadly. Although you and I, you know, I mean, I think we're lucky in a way, you know, with climate change. The classic, I'm sure the kind of classic ice climbing that we used to enjoy, I'm sure will exist at times in the British Isles, but it will be very transitory, I think.
It's getting more and more transitory. I believe there was a certain amount of ice climbing done on the Ben this year, but of course it's higher than the other crags, and you know it can actually build up snow. Here in Torridon, the ice and snow came and went about four or five times, and if you didn't catch it when it was there, you had no chance of doing a winter route. I did one in December, and that was
Oh, that's right, there was a brief flash, and you have to be almost on the spot these days. This is a difficult question in a way, but you're the person to ask it, I guess. What would you say was Harold Raeburn's legacy? Because obviously I think your book cements his role in the development of Scottish mountaineering, indeed world mountaineering, I guess. What do you feel that he achieved and brought to left us all, I suppose?
Well, he was the preeminent sort of alpinist and rock climber and winter climber of his day.
Yeah.
The fact that he was selected as climbing leader of the Everest expedition, you know, was about the highest honor a climber could have.
Yes.
You know, that is part of what his fame rests on. But then there's this huge volume of climbs all over Scotland. I think that's really his legacy. And again, there's the large number of guideless ascents which he did in Norway, the Alps, and the Caucasus. Yeah. You know, yeah. I think his reputation hangs on these things. But if it was just one thing, I think it's the Scottish winter climbing. I think that's really where he excelled.
Yes.
He was a very good rock climber as well, but winter climbing, I think, was very much his thing. And he, you know, leaves a big legacy with routes like Observatory Ridge, Raeburn's Gully on Loch na Garr,
yeah.
Max Black's Buttress, which was another of his, not credited to him, but credited to him now. The Great Ridge in Ardgour, you know, all these routes, classics nowadays. Mm-hmm. Crowberry Gully, first ascent, first summer ascent, first winter ascent.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, those are. He picked up some of the great classics, and certainly, you know, I don't think you can. It's difficult today, I suppose, to express what an achievement something like Green Gully was all those years ago, because that was a long time ago, and he was really pushing the boundaries there, I think.
Well, if you look at Raeburn at the top of Green Gully, John, he obviously went to that part of it where there was a large cornice. And he got Fildius belayed to his ice axe below the cornice, and he cut steps as far as he could. Then he drove his ice axe horizontally into the cornice, right, got himself up to be able to stand on it, and got his hands over the top. But of course, this was hard neve, and he couldn't get anything to hang on to.
Yeah, yeah.
So he experienced a moment of absolute, not panic, but almost despair, because he knew if he came off, they were both going to die.
Yeah.
So what does he do? He climbs back down again to where Fildius is, takes Fildius's axe, meaning that they now have no belay whatever.
No belay whatsoever, no.
No. He climbs back up his own steps, and he manages to cut a step. He cut a handhold over the top, and he manages to grovel over the cornice. It really is quite remarkable.
Yes, I don't think I would have been an ice climber in 1907. I have to.
No,
they were made of sterner stuff than me. Well, I think it's a tremendous achievement, and I think I always wonder. This is a question I don't know if you'll be able to answer, but mm-hmm. Whenever I'm writing something like that, I always wonder. What do you think? What do you think Harold Raeburn would say about your biography? Because he seems to have been a very modest man. He might actually have found it too overbearing.
He's a strange mixture of qualities, John.
Right.
Yes, he was very modest, but he wasn't devoid of pride.
Right.
Pride of his own achievements. My feeling is that he would be quietly glad that somebody had actually written a book about him.
Right.
And I think he would go through it with a tooth comb to see that there weren't any mistakes.
See if he could find out all your mistakes.
Yeah.
Well, it's a great book, and it's been fascinating talking to you. So Harold Raeburn, The Steps of a Giant, is available on Amazon. It's also available from the Scottish Mountaineering Press, if I'm right. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Right, and it's I think if you're a if it sits very well on the shelf of anyone who is interested in the history or fascinated really by the history of Scottish mountaineering. Peter, thank you very much for talking to me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you, John.